This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The UK's digital tech scene is accelerating, and the proof is in the Unicorn Kingdom Pathfinder Awards. This year, we celebrate the next generation of pioneering startups that are shaping the tech landscape of tomorrow. The UK is a thriving ecosystem with access to global talent, cutting-edge research, and unparalleled investment opportunities. Your big idea belongs here. Visit great.gov.uk/UKPA to learn more.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Theo Leggett, and in this programme we'll be hearing from the World Economic Forum in Davos, where the powerful are rubbing shoulders with the influential and the incredibly wealthy. But everyone's waiting to see what the new US president will actually do. As solar power overtakes coal as a source of electricity in Europe, we'll be asking whether the drive towards cleaner energy can be sustained. Real Madrid has become the first football club to bring in more than €1 billion a year, and
Everest conquered. The New Zealander Edmund Hillary got his first mail and congratulatory telegrams from George Lowe, a fellow countryman and expedition colleague.
The cost of climbing Mount Everest in the modern era is about to get a lot steeper. Let's go first, though, to the Swiss ski resort of Davos. Its pristine slopes and fashionable restaurants have always been home to an upmarket clientele. But once a year, the merely wealthy give way to the super rich, as billionaires from the world of business fly into town by helicopter and private jet to rub shoulders with presidents and prime ministers at the World Economic Forum. Now, under usual circumstances, they'd all spend a happy week discussing what to do about pressing global issues such as poverty and climate change. But this year is a little different. President Trump, fresh from his inauguration, isn't at the event itself, but he will be addressing it by video link within the next hour or so. And questions over what he will and will not be doing during his second term of office have been dominating conversations between delegates. For some, Trump 2.0 is something to be welcomed. Others are deeply nervous. And that's partly because of his plans to impose hefty tariffs or taxes on imports from other countries, as he outlined in his inauguration address earlier this week.
Instead of taxing our citizens to enrich other countries, we will tariff and tax foreign countries to enrich our citizens. For this purpose, we are establishing the External Revenue Service to collect all tariffs, duties, and revenues. It will be massive amounts of money pouring into our treasury, coming from foreign sources.
Well, that's what he said, but it's not wholly clear what those tariffs will be, when they'll be imposed, or what other countries might do to retaliate. The World Trade Organization's Director General Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala warned delegates at Davos that a trade war would be hugely damaging.
If we have tit-for-tat retaliation, whether it's 25%, tariff 60%, and we go to where we were in the 1930s, we are going to see double-digit global GDP losses. Double-digit. That's catastrophic. Everyone will pay. Everyone.
And if that wasn't enough, another issue creating uncertainty is the future of the NATO alliance. The new US president wants NATO members in Europe to increase their defence spending rather than relying so much on American funds. The NATO chief, Mark Rutte, says all of this has put the alliance in a crisis mode. He told delegates in Davos that European nations had no option but to increase their military spending to at least 2% of economic output and to be prepared to pay an awful lot more than that.
Much more to be spent, fast. The ones not on 2% have to get to the 2% in the next couple of months. We cannot wait any longer. And then we have collectively to move up, and we will decide on the exact number later this year, but it will be considerably more than that too. And then on industry production, we are really in a bad place here.
Well, Creon Butler is Director of the Global Economy and Finance Programme at Chatham House. He joins me now. Welcome to the programme.
Hello.
Well, let's start, Creon, with that rather apocalyptic warning from the head of the WTO. I mean, is the risk of a global trade war something we should be taking seriously, and is it likely?
I think it is something that we should take seriously, and she's right that if it actually happened, the losses both for the US and for the rest of the world would be very, very substantial. I think the WEF published some research today looking at a scenario for market fracturing, which suggested that the loss to the global economy would be close to $6 trillion, which is around 5% of global GDP. But of course, whether that actually happens is another question. And indeed, President Trump, in the first few days in office, has to some extent repeated what he said during the campaign. But what he's actually done is announced a number of reviews into trade arrangements with a range of different partners. And I think other countries will wait and see what concretely he proposes before taking action. I think it's also, just to go to what Dr. Ngozi said, I mean, I think other countries, if the president does impose tariffs, they may well say, well, actually, we are planning to retaliate, and these are the things we would do. And they would probably be quite targeted in terms of really quite sensitive areas within the US. But we're not going to impose them immediately, because what we want to do is to have a negotiation. And the question is whether that could turn around into a series of bilateral trade negotiations, the results of which are not that serious.
Is there an element of performative politics here, Creon? Because it's often said about Donald Trump that he'll say one thing, and then what we actually get in concrete terms is very, very different. That he's trying to put pressure on people in order to get what he and the people behind him really want.
I think that's the best way of interpreting his approach. And if you look in the sort of Trump one phase in his negotiations on the what was then called the NAFTA agreement, the North America Free Trade Agreement with US and Canada, he started with a very aggressive approach. And then after quite a lengthy negotiation, one ended up with a pretty much similar agreement, some modernization, some updates, but something that everybody could live with and was called a new name, US-Mexico-Canada Agreement. But fundamentally, it wasn't a shutting down of the trade relationships between the US and its closest partners. So you could expect similar outcomes vis-a-vis other countries. But frankly, we just don't know.
And what about NATO? Because it's all very well to say European countries have to put more money in, and there's an argument that that would only be fair anyway. But on the other side of the coin, European governments don't have a lot of money to spare at the moment.
It's true. I think all of them are committed to, at least those who haven't already met the sort of 2% target, are already committed to raising the amount they contribute from their own budgets. I mean, Germany is particularly in an acute position because it's a long way below that 2% target, as indeed Canada is as well, I believe. They all have that goal. But as you say, they are extremely stretched in terms of their budget situation. And I think it's a real question of prioritization, not just because President Trump is saying you should do this, but also because of the much riskier world that we now live in, the threat from Russia, the greater tensions with China. This is a sensible thing to do. And I think it needs to be a higher priority than it has been in the past.
Creon, thank you very much indeed. That was Creon Butler, Director of the Global Economy and Finance Programme at Chatham House. Now, the European Union obtained more of its electricity from solar power than from coal for the first time ever last year. That's according to a new report from the Clean Energy Policy Research Group, EMBER. It said solar power was used to generate 11% of the region's electricity, while coal accounted for 10%. Gas generation fell for the fifth year in a row to 29%. EMBER said the decline of coal and gas had cut power sector emissions to less than half of the levels seen at their peak back in 2007. So it certainly sounds like an important moment, but is it? That's a question I put to Dr. Carol Nachle, Chief Executive of Crystal Energy.
We should not be surprised. And actually, we should kind of look at it as a silver lining from the energy crisis that the EU faced in 2022. And we also felt it here in the UK because it accelerated the shift towards greener sources of energy. And this is definitely a positive moment for the EU, which is probably the most aggressive region in the world in pursuing the climate agenda. And they tightened their targets for clean energy after that crisis. So such an outcome does not surprise price, but it's definitely a landmark moment. Now, the big question is, can be sustained? Because we're not sure whether we're going to continue to see the capacity expansion maintained or the wind generation capacity maintained, because this is not always constant.
And there has been a lot of investment in solar power, particularly over the last few years.
Absolutely, because we receive lots of support from governments across the EU. But I have to highlight an important here caveat. We're talking about the EU, the European Union, which is a group of several countries, and the numbers we're looking at are the aggregate level and the average level that we see across the Union. But when you look at it at a more micro level, which means you look at individual countries, the picture is not as rosy. So you still have, for example, countries such as Poland with a huge dependence on coal. I think, if I'm not mistaken, around 60% of their electricity generation is coming from coal. So we have to be careful about not celebrating too soon, because when you look at each country, it's not the same picture that emerges.
And of course, there's a political dimension to this as well, isn't there? Coal mining, it's big in parts of Germany, big in Poland. So the momentum for change could slow down if those mines need to be protected for political purposes.
I think it's definitely an argument to be made with respect to Poland because of the labor unions and the strong influence of the mining sector. Now, I don't accept it, but I understand it because it's an employment, it's an important employer in the country. But there's definitely this political and social and economic dimension that for Poland is important. Add to that the fact that they are producing their own resources at a low cost. So for them, it makes also economic sense to sustain coal for a longer period, even if it's coming at the expense of the climate agenda.
All of this progress that we're seeing, that has come at a pretty heavy cost, hasn't it?
It depends on who is paying for it, because definitely you do have support from governments. The industry continues to be subsidized in many parts of the European Union. It's getting lots of support from the European Union. Whereas when you look at fossil fuel, they are major taxpayers to the government. So that's another thing we should consider, that the more we support green energy, we have to accept that we're also losing potential income coming from the fossil fuel industry. But maybe that's a price worth paying.
And I guess you mentioned yourself the energy crisis. There is a certain amount of Europe didn't have any choice in all of this anyway.
It is limited. So that's why when we think about the future, it's not a guarantee that what the trend that we have seen in the last few years is going to be maintained at the same speed. There is the infrastructure problem. There is giving further licenses to expand wind and solar capacity. We're already seeing the solar industry in countries such as Germany struggling financially. And we saw some companies went bankrupt recently. So there is big question mark into how much we can sustain looking ahead in the coming years in terms of infrastructure and capacity generation. And there are also some policy bottlenecks that the EU has to address. Whereas at the same time, you do have more gas available coming from other more secure sources, such as the United States and Qatar. We heard about the big contract that Qatar, for instance, signed with some countries in the EU, such as Germany. So this gives, like, you need a delicate balancing act between these various available resources for the EU.
And that was Dr. Carol Nachle, Chief Executive of Crystal Energy. Don't forget, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners, on any of the issues raised in this programme. You can contact us on WhatsApp or send us a voice note. The number is +44 330 678 3033.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates. Fly better.
Warum nur an der Oberfläche kratzen? Bei einem Atemwegsinfekt ganz dünnes Eis.
Wenn Erkältungsviren auf die Bronchien schlagen, packt Umkaluabo den Infekt mit der Wurzel. Denn es lindert nicht nur die Symptome, sondern bekämpft auch die Erreger.
Umkaluabo. Unaussprechlich, aber ausgesprochen gut.
Zu Risiken und Nebenwirkungen lesen Sie die Packungsbeilage und fragen Sie Ihre Ärztin, Ihren Arzt oder in Ihrer Apotheke.
Three. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Let's check in on what's been preoccupying the financial markets today. And Emma Wall is Head of Platform Investments at Hargreaves Lansdown. She joins me now. Hello, Emma.
Hello.
So I guess you're looking at Donald Trump and you're looking at what's going on in Davos.
Absolutely. And the two combined, because as you said earlier, the theme of Davos, despite the fact of him not actually being there, is very much Trump and what he's going to do next in this second administration. And we've been looking with interest in particular about the impact of tariffs, but not just tariffs, also the tax cuts that he has sort of, you know, drip fed and through the election period of potential lower corporation tax and lower personal taxes. That combined with tariffs, we think could be very inflationary for the US. And of course, we know that inflation does have a contagion effect and therefore is likely to be inflationary for the UK and for Europe as well. We've also been looking at the impact of tariffs on particular companies. Very interesting note out this morning from Bank of America, because of course, on Inauguration Day, he announced that he was going to put 25% import tariffs on Mexico and Canada. But that doesn't just affect those two nations. It affects businesses that have those nations in their supply chain. So really interestingly, going to be big impact if those go through on Stellantis, Volkswagen, Mercedes, Volvo, BMW. So big auto companies in Europe, but also businesses like Nestle, consumer goods firms. So when these tariffs come through, think about the impact, not just for that local GDP and those local businesses, but the global businesses that have those countries in their supply chain.
OK, but just clear something up for me, Emma. We're always being told that markets hate uncertainty, that that's what causes volatility, what causes investors to get out of the market. And yet at the moment, we've got a huge amount of uncertainty, but the markets have been doing rather well.
They have, but they have been volatile. So you've had quite really interesting moves in intraday and indeed in companies. And this has been going on for about 6 months since you began to see actually Donald Trump gathering pace. Also, the global markets have started really interesting this year, with Europe doing much better than the US. And that's mostly because you had such considerable gains in the US in November, December, quite what we call a Santa rally, because of the expectation that Trump is going to be positive for stock markets with those lower corporation taxes and those lower personal taxes. However, I wouldn't expect it to be plain sailing from here. Very much baked into our 2025 outlook is continued volatility for both stock markets and fixed income markets.
Well, everyone tries to work out what the policies are actually going to be. Just away from Donald Trump for a moment, another story you've been looking at, European chief executives getting increasingly concerned about growth and what governments are or are not doing about it.
Absolutely. This is another story from Davos, and it's Richard Node, so vice chairman of Goldman Sachs International Operations, saying that he'll expect CEOs in Europe to start to get very frustrated with the lack of what he sees as action from European politicians to fix the fact that in Europe, they've got a real growth problem. So very different from the US, where inflation is indeed running hot, but also GDP is pretty healthy. You know, the consumer has been propping up the US economy there. In Europe and indeed the UK, we've had anemic or indeed negative growth. And he expects actually corporates to become much more vocal in terms of their demands from politicians and policies to stoke up that growth.
OK, Emma, we'll have to leave it there. That was Emma Wall, head of platform investments at Hargreaves Lansdown. And thank you very much. Now, from the English Premier League to Italy's Serie A to La Liga in Spain, top-level football is big business and it's getting bigger. In the 2023 to 2024 season, Real Madrid became the first club to generate more than €1 billion in revenues. That's a little over $1 billion. And all of this is according to the latest football money report from consultants Deloitte. Now, the Spanish club was followed in the list by Manchester City, which is backed by the United Arab Emirates, and Qatari-owned Paris Saint-Germain, who played one another on Tuesday, in fact, in a true clash of the financial titans. But hefty commercial income does not always mean good financial health. Dr. Christina Philippoussis is Associate Professor in Accounting and Sports Finance at the University of Portsmouth, and she's been looking through the figures for me.
Well, it is a huge amount of money. It comes from three sources. One is match day, which is what you get, you know, ticket sales, and that includes VIP and general seating. Then there's the commercial, which is all the sponsorship deals and the partnerships. And then you have broadcasting.
So this is a lot of money, but high income doesn't always equal financial health, does it? And we've seen that in the past.
Oh, absolutely not. And there's a reason why the Deloitte Money League always looks at the revenues coming in, because that shows how much money a club can generate. But yes, if you look at what is left at the end of the day after all the wages and other costs are paid out, a lot of these clubs actually make losses.
And just looking at Real Madrid, I mean, they brought Jude Bellingham in 2023 for more than 100 million euros, I think, and their squad is full of people with that kind of valuation. So when you're buying that calibre of player, a billion euros doesn't actually go that far, does it?
No, it doesn't. And that's why a lot of clubs actually struggle with their finances, because what we see traditionally is, as particularly as broadcast income goes up, the wages tend to kind of follow a similar pattern, because traditionally it's broadcasting that has been leading the way in terms of high rises. What we're actually seeing this year and the last couple of years actually is a shift towards the big increases are actually coming on match days. And a lot of that is to do with stadium redevelopment.
And you were talking there about the prices of players. I mean, this is the key, isn't it? It's not just the transfer costs, it's the wage costs as well. And even the biggest clubs struggle. I mean, a couple of years ago, we saw Barcelona nearly going to the wall.
Yes, absolutely. And Barcelona are not out of the woods yet. They've obviously struggled to register some of the players because their finances weren't quite where they would have liked them to be. And the big issue there is the cost of players, right? And that's a combination of the transfer cost and the wages, which both attributed to actual players. And that is by far the biggest cost for all clubs.
We shouldn't forget that the clubs aren't equal. It's not just about the revenues, is it? It's about the backing that owners are willing to put in. And, you know, just yesterday in the UEFA Champions League, we had Manchester City, which is backed by Abu Dhabi, playing Paris Saint-Germain, which is owned by effectively by the Qatari government. These are clubs which have tremendous financial resources. I guess the likes of Real Madrid, they have to make a lot of revenue from selling shirts and the like, because they're up against people with virtually unlimited resources.
Well, it's not quite so simple, because there are financial regulations to kind of limit the amount of money that can be put in from ownership groups or owners who have a lot of money to put in. And part of the reason for that is because football needs to be competitive, because if there isn't competition and if it's just about who can put more money in and win all the leagues and everything, then less people would want to watch. So broadcasting income would go down, match day income would go down, and commercial income would go down, because sponsors wouldn't want to be associated, people wouldn't want to watch, and so that would not be good for football as a whole. So what leagues do, what the governing bodies do, is put in financial regulations to try and kind of limit that. However, of course, the rules just govern certain things. So, of course, the more revenue and the more resources a club has, the more they can pump it into other things. So youth, women's, stadium development, a lot of that we're seeing from clubs with more resources.
That was Dr. Christina Philippou of the University of Portsmouth. It's 103 years since a group of intrepid climbers led by Brigadier General Charles Granville Bruce first attempted to climb Mount Everest. It's more than 70 years since Tenzing Norgay and Edmund Hillary made the first successful ascent. Here's Edmund Hillary speaking about that climb.
Tenzing and I had been climbing together a good deal, and I think we'd become a fairly happy pair. And this was just one example of how a pair rope together are a unit, and how one is always protecting the other. I was leading down the icefall, and when I was crossing a crevasse, a large lump of ice gave way on which I was standing, and I set off down the down a crevasse. Well, Tenzing, who was following, had the rope tight in a very short time and pulled me up, so I didn't go very far.
Well, these days, with the help of guides, Sherpas, oxygen and modern mountaineering equipment, many more people can hope to reach the top of the world. For Nepal, while the steady flow of climbers has become a vital source of income, there is a downside. The mountains become littered with rubbish, while overcrowding has led to climbers being forced to queue in dangerous conditions close to the summit. The Nepalese government has now decided to increase the cost of climbing permits during the peak season from $11,000 to $15,000. Tim Mosdale is a climber who's reached the top himself seven times. He runs a company offering expeditions to the Himalayan peaks, including Everest.
It can be quite busy on certain days, but the analogy that I would give is that it can also be very busy in Brighton on a bank holiday Monday. But if you can go there the Wednesday before or the Thursday after, then you'll have a much quieter time.
We have heard that at peak times there is overcrowding, and that there have been problems over the past few years, well-documented problems with rubbish. Do you think the decision to increase the cost of climbing permits by the Nepalese government is justified?
In real terms, it reflects probably a 3% annual increase year on year since it was increased about a decade ago to 11,000. So, you know, although it's a hike of $4,000 in one go, in real terms, there's an incremental increase. It's fairly standard. It's a difficult one. It will partly perhaps reduced numbers. Unfortunately, that then becomes a bit of a differential between those that can afford and those that maybe can't quite afford. So some people might have to defer their wishes by a year or two to raise the extra money. But a lot of the money is put back into, as you've just mentioned, there's rubbish on the mountain and they do have some cleanup operations occasionally. The rubbish isn't as bad as it used to be, but there are still cleanup operations and some of those are funded by the Nepalese government.
Is there a case for saying Everest needs fewer climbers paying more?
Unfortunately, that then becomes a bit elitist. The outdoors, hopefully, is for everyone to enjoy. But, you know, there are plenty of other mountains around the world where you have to pay to enjoy that environment. So, you know, it's not as if it's the only mountain that you have to pay for. If it was a cheaper option, undoubtedly it would be busier, and that in turn could create some big problems. So, you know, I think there's a very delicate balance, and, you know, we'll see next season. So it's, the increase isn't for this spring, it's for the following spring, spring 26. And, you know, we'll see what happens in terms of numbers then, I guess.
You were talking about elitism, but it is kind of elitist now, isn't it? I've just been looking at your own prices on your website, and the cost of your expedition for 2025 starts at $54,000. So this is either people putting a lifetime's worth of savings into it or being very rich, isn't it?
I don't know about a lifetime's worth of savings. There's an argument that if you've got a VW Transporter van, a MacBook Pro Retina display, an iPhone, you know, top of the range, et cetera, and you go on two holidays a year, then arguably it's within reach if you were to cut back on certain areas of your life. So I don't think it's quite as elitist as people would make out. The costs are very high. You know, the permit has to be paid for per person, but also for the expedition leader, their place needs to be accounted for. The oxygen is probably about $8,000 to $10,000 worth per person. The climbing Sherpas are $7,000 to $12,000, $15,000 per Sherpa. The base camp facilities are probably about $10,000 to $12,000 per person. So, you know, there's some very high overhead. You know, there's not much left over. And my price is reasonably low compared to some of the 80, 90, 100 and something thousand that you can easily spend with other expeditions where you don't necessarily get much in the way of added value.
So it's a bit of a juggling act to make sure enough income's coming in without putting off too many people.
Absolutely, absolutely. The hike in the peak permit isn't going to necessarily put off the trekkers, but it could discourage a number of people going on expedition. But considering there's, you know, sort of 350 or so who might be signing up for expeditions, if you lost 10%, you're only losing 35 or so places. Whereas with the trekkers, you know, there's far many more trekkers than there are people climbing the mountain who are enjoying the region.
Well, if you wanted to climb Mount Everest, you now know how much it'll cost you to do so. That was Tim Mosdell, who organises expeditions. And that's it from this edition of World Business Report. I'm Theo Leggett. Bye for now.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates. Fly better.